Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Sam, and I'm so glad that you can join me for a brand new episode of Wax Ecstatic in a brand new year. Yes, we have turned the calendar to 2020, or 2020. Or as Baba Walters would say, 2020. Yeah, that's the big joke that is definitely by now, January 3rd, already pretty ridiculously old. And you know what else is old? Leftovers. We all have the leftovers. And it varies from house to house and person to person, but whatever is left over from your Christmas meal, your Hanukkah meal, your Kwanzaa meal, your Orthodox Christian meal, whatever you celebrate this time of year, chances are sometime in the last couple of weeks, you not only had a big dinner to celebrate, but you also had people just dumping food in your lap, figuratively, not literally, hopefully, but just people just delivering cookies and cakes and fudge and chocolate and chocolate-covered, fudge-covered cakes with chocolate fudge in the middle. It's just so much. And I'm so glad I finally figured out a few years ago that I should never schedule my annual physical in early January. It's amazing how much your cholesterol drops when you've got a month to work off all that garbage you ate in December. But I digress. You know, it's November and December. It's just gluttony because it really starts with the Halloween candy. And once you've polished off your kids' Halloween candy, then it's Thanksgiving Day. So you load up on Thanksgiving food and have leftovers of that. And then, like I said, everyone's dropping baked goods off at your front door. And then all of a sudden you're having your holiday and your New Year's meals. And then by January, you're going, oh, God. What have I done to myself? And with that in mind, I decided to do this show in honor of leftovers. Some leftovers are good, other leftovers are not. And I'm not going to be talking about food here. We are talking about baseball cards. And I decided just to, you know, mix things up a little bit. I like to do this every now and then. I decided to go on eBay and buy one of those random assortment of packages. And I've had some luck with these, others not so much. But I figured, what the hell? This could be fun. I have no idea what's coming in the mail. This is something that I normally just do by myself. I'll order that big box of random cello packs or whatever and just open them up for myself. I've never done it for the show. So I figured, let me just go to somebody who I haven't bought from before. So it's a little bit of mystery and intrigue for everybody. And let me just buy one of these random assortment packs, see what I've got. And on top of seeing the cards that I have, as we do with every show, dive into some biological stories of or biographical stories. I don't want to do biological stories. That could get interesting. That's the Steve Garvey show. That's for another time. But the biographical stories of several players. And I figured, you know, we'll go ahead and just do that and maybe make the podcast a little shorter than normal because, you know, the last episode was almost 2 hours. It was an hour and 40 minutes, I think. And it was all about 89 Upper Deck. And of course, you're going to spend lots of time about 89 Upper Deck. It really changed the course of the hobby for good and bad. And you're going to go over time on that. In fact, the first time I did a podcast on 89 Upper Deck, it was back in 2016. That was one of the longer shows at the time. But you have to, because there's such a story behind it. There is life in baseball card collecting before Upper Deck and after Upper Deck. So you have to kind of go long on that. So it's, you know, the last episode was basically the holiday gluttony, and this is the leftovers show. We're just going to pick at some of the bare bones here and hopefully have a slightly shorter show here, and they'll kind of balance out just a little bit before we really get back into the swing of things in a couple of weeks with our next show, which will be coming up 2 weeks from today. That will be Friday, January 17th, and we will see what fun and frivolity we have lined up for you then. But looking forward to kind of getting back into the swing of things as January goes into full effect here, since we just started the month and just started the new year. So make sure you join us on January 17th, noon Eastern. That's when the show drops on Audio Boom and all of our RSS feeds that go out to Apple Podcast, as well as iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, Blueberry, Google Play, and Spotify, as well as many other platforms I don't even recall or don't even know that's going out there. But you found me, so congratulations. If the platform you listen on allows you to rate and review the show, please do so. And please be honest. Most people, if you've gotten this far, you've liked the show so far. Most people have some positive thoughts, but please do share them, as that helps us move the show up in the algorithm, especially with Apple Podcast. If you give us a five-star review and have lots of nice things to say, the show gets moved up in the listing of suggested podcasts for other listeners of sports and sports collectibles. So that's always an easy way to help promote the show, and we appreciate your comments and the time taking out to do those. Also, if you want to comment about the program or the sets that we talk about, the players we talk about, or just the hobby in general, you can join me on Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains. That is open 24/7. So anything you want to talk about with the sport, or again, with the hobby in general, or anything about the show, we certainly appreciate any feedback. And we certainly appreciate cash donations as well. Always looking for a little bit of assistance with the program. If you want to make a cash donation, you could do so at paypal.me/waxecstatic. Again, that is paypal.me/waxecstatic. And we've picked up some donations recently. One that came in just right after I think I recorded the last show. I want to give a heads up to Roy Carlson. Thank you so much for your donation, Roy. And he mentions, Matt, discovered your podcast about a year or so ago, listened to all the vintage ones and found them very entertaining. Been collecting since 1969. Thanks for diving into so many different subjects. Keep it going. Thank you very much, Roy, not only for the kind comments, but again, for the donation. And as Roy and many other people have discovered, we take the donations that you do make and bring them right back into the program in one of two ways. We will, first of all, basically support the program from a technical standpoint. It does cost us an annual fee to keep the show on Audio Boom. And also, it helps us keep the archives free if we have some kind-hearted people putting out some donations there. We could, if we wanted to, put the older shows, the first, 120 or so episodes, we could put it behind a paywall and charge a $3.99 for unlimited access or what have you. But I like to keep things free, if possible. That's how we work in digital media and social media these days. So, you know, it's nice if we can get a few donations here and there to keep that happening and keep the show, again, alive and well on Audio Boom and all those channels it goes out to. And then the second way that we utilize your money is we make purchases of cards, packs, boxes, you name it, whatever we discuss on the show. It helps us be a little more selective and a little more open to bidding for certain items and purchasing certain items as well, not just on eBay or other online methods, but also through local card shops, local card show here in Tampa Bay where I live. And every penny helps. Every dollar helps. So we certainly appreciate all the contributions. We've been able to pick a few up over the last couple of months. So those who have donated, thank you. Those who haven't, if you haven't completely wasted your bank account on either baked goods or Christmas gifts, if you have, even if it's just $5 or $10, feel free to donate it to paypal.me/waxecstatic. And one final note that I always like to mention with all the donations that we do get, when we go out, we purchase some of these cards to open up and talk about on the program. What I like to do is the excess product, which, probably I'd say 80% of the cards that we open up here or we discuss I actually move along to Commons for Kids, a great group that takes common sports cards and non-sports cards too, but common cards and donates them to children. And it's not just children who are maybe in the hospital or in a medical center dealing with a medical issue and they need something to pick them up, but also kids who are a little just down on their luck. And a lot of kids don't have it as well as you or I did when we were kids. And anytime you can pick kids up with something fun like sports cards, absolutely, you want to take part in that. And also it helps connect kids to the hobby and to the sport of baseball, or like I said, any other sports that you donate cards for. So consider, as you start your spring cleaning, now that you've gotten the people out of your house and you finally dragged that browning Christmas tree out of your house and you're, you know, cleaning up the mess that was made over the last 2-3 weeks, as you do your spring cleaning and as you go through your card collection and you organize things before the new 2020 models come out in a few weeks, go ahead, set aside those, not just common cards, but semi-star cards. Include some rookies. It doesn't have to all be junk wax early 1990s stuff. Get some good stuff too. Send it to the folks at Commons for Kids and they will appreciate it and you'll feel good about yourself as well. And you can follow them on Twitter, Commons for Kids. That's the number 4, to learn more about their operation and what they do. And we appreciate all that they do, not only for helping kids get connected to the sport and get connected to the hobby, but also, let's be honest, we like to keep our collections nice and tidy. And when your card boxes runneth over, Commons for Kids is a great place to send those extra cards to. Now, speaking of extras, we will get to our main topic, which is the leftover packs. I'm going to play a little spoiler here. Nothing great happened from the packs that we got. In fact, the packs weren't all that great. More about that in a little bit. You can watch the video break of that, by the way. Just go on to YouTube and type in Wax Ecstatic Leftovers Break, and you'll see what splendid gizzards we got in the wax packs that did show up in the mail a few days ago. And before we do that, I do want to give a tip of the cap to Sports Collectors Digest. We all remember Sports Collectors Digest still humming along every year and putting out great magazines. I was going to say episodes, not quite episodes, still putting out publications, not just in print, but also online. And Wax Ecstatic was one of 10 podcasts that were featured by Brian Flynn in an issue that came out. It was actually dated today, January 3rd, 2020. But we were one of 10 podcasts that were featured in the growing world of sports podcast, sports card podcast, I should say. So thank you very much, Brian. Brian actually interviewed me way back in early August, I think. And in the world of freelance media, this is how it typically works. You have an idea and you pitch it and your editor says, great, go do it. And then it just kind of meanders and things get delayed and pushed back and things get added and subtracted to the story. But in the end, Brian did a nice write-up of the top 10, if you will, sports card podcast. And I'm very happy to be one of the 10 here. So thank you, Brian, not only for doing that feature on all the podcasts, but I want to thank all of our listeners for making Wax Ecstatic what it is. In fact, I had to take a break from doing the show back, what was it, December of 2017. I just needed a break. You know, the show had kind of run its course. I was really busy with what I was doing in work and in life and just needed a little bit of a time out. So we sat out for, 6 or 7 months. And, you know, it was because of listeners, longtime listeners to the first series of the show, if you will, who were basically going, you know what, we kind of miss you. So that's what brought it back. And I'm forever thankful that you did bring it back. So thanks for not only bringing the show back or kicking me in the ass enough to bring it back, but also for continuing to support it all these years now. Once we get to July or August, we'll be approaching 4 years of covering most of these shows here. By the way, an interesting comment or a couple comments from our listeners on wax and gum stains before we get to the main point of this week's podcast. Great points from our 89 Upper Deck show. A lot of people mentioning that It's so funny, and I mentioned this in the show too, how a lot of people have lost so much money and time and focus trying to track down a Ken Griffey Jr. rookie card in 89 Upper Deck that often, and like I said, I mentioned this, you forget that Fleer and Donruss and Bowman all had Ken Griffey Jr. rookie cards in their base sets. Score and Topps would add one to their bonus sets, the Topps traded set and the Score update set. But you still have many other options to get your hands on a Ken Griffey Jr. rookie card, and they're still pretty valuable. You know, the Donruss and Fleer cards, depending on the condition. I know Pack Fresh, if you will, anywhere from $6 to $8, which for a card from 1989, you know, we're rolling right into the meat of the junk wax era. That's actually a hefty price for a Pack Fresh card. So then, of course, if you get it graded and you get a high grading, it's going to bump up the value quite a bit. But, you know, there's still plenty of Ken Griffey Jr. rookie cards in Fleer and Bowman and Score, or excuse me, Donruss. And it's a whole lot easier to get your hands on boxes and packs of Fleer and Donruss, and especially Bowman from 1989. But because of everything that Upper Deck was in 1989, so many people still hang out their hopes when they buy those packs that they're going to get an Upper Deck rookie card. And one of our listeners, Robert J. Lawson, brought up regarding the hobby just prior to Upper Deck, isn't it funny that the thought of pulling an 87 Bo Jackson, Jose Canseco, Barry Bonds, or Will Clark still sounds more exciting than pulling an 88 Tom Glavine, Roberto Alomar, Edgar Martinez, or Craig Biggio? All the 88s are Hall of Famers. Isn't that something? And of course, you should argue that Will Clark should be in the Hall of Fame. I'm sure he'll get his opportunity. And because of the steroid allegations, Canseco and Bonds, maybe one day they get in there, but I think it's going to be a while. Bo Jackson, of course, his career cut way too short due to injuries. But yeah, that's the mystique of not only 89 Upper Deck, but also the three major car brands from 1987. Topps, Fleer, and Donruss put out great sets. They had a great rookie class. Yet the fervor for the rookies from 1988, all, Robert, as you pointed out, all Hall of Famers, a lot of people don't really invest much time or interest into those. And again, you know, the production of these cards was ramped up considerably then, and you've got the market flooded a little bit with that product. But you're right, if you're somebody who wants to collect Hall of Fame rookie cards, it's a whole lot easier to get some in 88 than it is in 87, and certainly compared to 89 Upper Deck as well. Also, we had Terry Leaders went out and bought the baseball jumbo box. And let's see. Yeah, this is one of those kind of Walgreens jumbo boxes that we've seen before. He points out that there was an 83 Negro, a couple Hall of Famers, a checklist, two hockey cards. And by the way, the hockey cards are from 88, 89, and they are very common players. These were the 25th guys on the 25-man roster for the Flyers and Red Wings, respectively. And also, as Terry points out, the dreaded manager card with a print mark, yes, 91 Topps Bobby Valentine. Although looking at some of these pictures here, you got some pretty interesting cards, including 90 score Bo Jackson. You got a Roy Holiday, what is that, a 2001 Topps, I believe. Some interesting minor league cards as well. And some notable names, but the 91 Score Series 1, boy, that's almost as bad as the 90 Donruss wax pack that I got in mine. And speaking of 90 Donruss, that was one of the cards, or one of the packs that ended up in the leftover pack that I bought recently. I didn't ask for it. They just kind of threw it in there. Of course. All right, let's dive into that pack, shall we? Again, this was just one of those things that I did. I figured, well, this will be fun. This will be different. And, of course, that's the whole reason why companies or individuals put these packs together. Much like when you get four random packs of 89 Upper Deck, there's that outside chance that you will land a Griffey rookie, and hopefully it's a PSA 9 or 10 out of the pack, which is harder than you think it is, but that's what you hope. You're hoping that in these mishmash of variety packs that are thrown together, you will land the 85 tops pack that you open up and has a McGuire rookie or a Clemens rookie or a Puckett rookie, you know, at least something that's got some value that at least makes your money back or most of your money back on whatever you spend on it. And there's all sorts of varieties of these packs. They're the ones that we've talked about before that are typically sold in a Walmart or a Target setting where for $20 you get a box with 20 packs and you're thinking, well, it's a dollar a pack. That's not a bad deal. And, you know, on the surface, it's not. But as I've typically found, of the 20 packs, really only six or seven of them are really worth your time. And, you know, maybe it's a recent Topps or a recent Topps Heritage or a recent Allen and Ginter pack that's kind of thrown in there. But most of the packs are, you know, junk wax era stuff. There's a couple 90 Fleers. There's a couple 90 Donruss. There's a couple 91 Scores. And then sometimes you have the real garbage that's just thrown in there. There's four or five, you know, special, quote unquote, limited edition subsets that were produced at some point in time that maybe feature some Hall of Fame players from the 30s and 40s, or maybe it's like a Babe Ruth set that somebody just had the yearning to make and couldn't sell. So, you know, all these packs end up in these variety pack boxes. So it's always, you have to be cautious with the pack boxes. And especially if you're spending $20 on 20 packs, like I said, maybe five, six, seven of them contain something or could contain something that is of value. Now, I have heard stories of people who have bought those packs and they do get, say, a 2016 Topps Heritage pack and they open it up and there's some, you know, game used authenticated, you know, jersey swath, or there's an autograph card in there, or there's a big rookie card from that particular set, and then it's really worth it. But nine times out of 10, you're not going to get that. It's just going to be the pure luck or bad luck, if you will, of what you draw from there. So I went on eBay, and like I've said, I've bought these types of packs before. You know, going back a couple of years, I can think of a box of rack packs and cello packs. And I think I bought the box for, it was like $35. There were, I think, 25 packs in there. And of course, it includes shipping. And, you know, the seller, if you're ever going to buy one of these, make sure that the seller clearly tells you what you're going to get. If you go on to eBay or any other auction service or any other website for that fact, and you go buying one of these, and the seller describes it as, you know, a selection of 10 packs from these years, you know, 1987 to 1994, and that's kind of it. Buyer beware, because chances are you're going to be getting a lot more Donruss triple plays and 90 Bowmans and 91 Donruss Series 2 packs than you ever bargained for. So, you know, when I bought these cello and rack packs, the guy, you know, clearly stated, all right, you'll get X number from, you know, 1985 to 87, an X number 88 through 91. And when I looked at it, and, you know, he also made a, you know, promise, you'll get at least two cello packs from 1981 up. And, you know, you get an 84 and an 85 thrown in there. And overall, it wasn't that bad of a purchase. Again, a lot of your packs in these are going to be junk wax era packs, but at least the ones that were, I don't want to call them vintage, but the older packs from the grouping were at least worth the money you paid for the entire box. So I've had some good success. So this time I looked around and I found a seller. Not going to mention the seller's name, but the seller did have a pretty good rating, 100%, in fact, and also had a few thousand people that decided to give them a score, a rating, and I figured, okay, all right, we've got a large enough sample size here. We've got people that clearly like what they put out there. So I'm going to invest, I think it was something like with shipping, I think it was $17. And with it came an assortment of packs. It was described as, you will get one pre-1985 pack. Okay, check mark, that's good. You've teased me with some of the older stuff. All right. Then you're supposed to get one pack that has some kind of autographed stuff or the opportunity to get an autograph card. Okay, a chase pack. Fine, I'll go with that. Then you've got three packs from the junk wax era. Okay, that's how it's going to work. And then you had three non-sport packs. And I thought, well, this might be fun because maybe you're getting Garbage Pail Kids. Maybe you're getting Desert Storm or Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles or something like that. And you know what? Just for the hell of it, why not? I don't want to venture into non-sports cards here too often, but why not? So I buy the pack. And it gets shipped to me a lot faster than I thought it would. It was coming from California to Florida. So I get it, and I figure, all right, let's set up the camera. Let's get everything all set. Let's open it up. It was going to be news to me and news to you, the viewer, on what it was going to be. So I opened up the pack, and inside you've got an 81 Donruss pack. Okay, great. There's your pre-85 pack. Not the best, but I'll take it. Then you've got a 92 Fleer Fat Pack. Okay. Well, when you read the fine print, a jumbo pack is worth two packs. Aha! Kind of got you there, Matt. There's also a 91 Leaf Pack. Okay. There's also a 92 Score Pack. Okay. And then there are three non-sports packs. There is a pack of, I believe it was Series 6? Garbage Pail Kids from 1986. There was a pack of Desert Storm cards, Victory Series. So this must have been from 1991. After we rolled the tanks into Kuwait and Saddam Hussein quickly went backwards, we declared victory there. And then the other pack, which was very interesting, and I didn't open it. And I'm saving this. I'm going to open it one day for you guys because I'm sure you're going to love it because it's going to be tremendously awful. You know, kind of in a VH1 special awful. You know, it's going to be a terrible pack of cards. Somebody, it was Pro Set actually. So that even makes it even more terrible. Pro Set made terrible cards. So here's some terrible cards of a terrible topic. These are pop music cards from 1991. So I can hardly wait to rip open these Pro Set cards of pop music from 1991 so I can find my long sought after Tony or Criss Cross cards, Vanilla Ice. I hope that there's like a rookie cup on Vanilla Ice. And I can hardly wait to open those cards. So one day I've set it off. I'm going to open it because the music in 1991 was terrible, at least pop music. Of course, alternative music was starting to bubble up under the surface here. But pop music was awful. Pop culture was awful. The bright colors, the purples and the teals and the pinks and the Saved by the Bell, you know, kind of setting of life in North America in 1991 was all awful. So I'm really curious what's going to be in there. And I may do that in my next video offering. Also, I do want to bring up real quickly before we talk about the sports cards that came in, because I wasn't exactly blown away by what was inside the sports packages. If you watch the video, you'll see I decided to open up the Garbage Pail Kids pack. And I do have some memories, kind of fuzzy, about Garbage Pail Kids. I was, I believe, 8 years old when they came out, or nine. But I do want to know, and we'll put a poll question on wax and gum stains. Like I said, I don't want to divert into non-sports cards that often. In fact, hardly ever, to be honest with you. But Garbage Pail Kids, that was such a big thing in the mid to late 80s, which most of us were kids then. And it was so popular that Topps actually brought them back by demand a couple years ago. Should I buy some Garbage Pail Kids? We can open them up and we can kind of do a little history of Garbage Pail Kids. I will leave that to you, the listener. If we get an overwhelming response that says yes, I'll do that one show. If we get kind of this tepid or lukewarm response or only a couple people who are genuinely excited, then we'll pass it by. But I hadn't opened a pack of Garbage Pail Kids in 30 years. So it was kind of neat to open those up and reminisce to the best of my ability because my parents, my family, the good conservative Catholic family. We didn't buy that type of nonsense. We didn't have garbage pail kids in our house. Actually, we did. I shouldn't give my parents too much crap, because they did allow us at some point in time to spend a couple dollars and buy a few packs here and there. But there was a legitimate underground black market going on in my elementary school when Garbage Pail Kids came out. It was kind of like Airheads candy when I was in middle school. Boy, you talk about black market and almost like a mafioso operation of shuttling those things around junior high school and trying to make a buck off of Airheads. It was kind of the same thing with Garbage Pail Kids. So my parents, God bless them, they were not going to let us get duped by the smarter, richer kids in school. So we didn't invest too much money or time in it. But I do recall a little bit about the effect of Garbage Pail Kids, how they were basically blamed for everything that was wrong in society. You know, this was before Nintendo and Sega and online games were blamed for everything wrong in society. It was always the Garbage Pail Kids' fault. And, you know, you could actually get suspended from school if you brought them or if you traded them or tried to sell them. So there was a lot of hoopla around it. So, you know, I'll throw that out there. If you want a Garbage Pail Kids show, again, it's not baseball, but it is something that had such a major cultural effect, especially on our generations, that it may warrant, and it could be a fun podcast to do a little bit down the line. Plus, getting the vintage Garbage Pail Kids, depending on the year and the series, they're not cheap. So I'll have to shop wisely for those. Maybe I can find some at the upcoming card show, because I know there's a lot of dealers that do have some old non-sports cards from the 70s and 80s, and they just try to sell these packs cheap just to get rid of them. But that would be the only non-sports card show I do, if we did do it, simply because I don't want to sit here and, you know, go back through our Star Wars cards or Alf or Moonraker or Charlie's Angels or Dukes of Hazzards or, you know, any of those from the late 70s and early 80s. It wasn't really my thing then. It's just Garbage Pail Kids, much like Cabbage Patch Kids, the dolls in the mid 80s, had such a big cultural effect that it may be worth doing a show about. But I'll leave that up to you. Now, as for the cards, when I opened them, not a whole lot of great stuff. You know, the 81 Donruss, you know, it is what it is. It's 81 Donruss, very thin, flimsy cards. The bubblegum thoroughly baked into the Dave Stapleton card that was on the top of the pack. So that card was a waste. Thankfully, that was just Dave Stapleton. I have opened up some 81 Donruss with Pete Rose or Reggie Jackson with that big, thick slab of gum attached right through it, almost burning through the card. And that sucks. You got to throw out a card that's worth a dollar or two for the stinking terrible bubble gum that Donruss threw in there back in 1981. But, you know, nothing that really stood out in the 81 Donruss group, really, for all the cards. You know, the 92 Fleer, the 92 Score, not so much. You know, I found some interesting names in there. The 91 Leaf at least had John Smoltz. So that was early in his career. He's a Hall of Famer as well. So, you know, and I know that because Joe Buck calls him Hall of Famer John Smoltz every time he opens his mouth. I think Joe Buck farts and he goes, Hall of Famer John Smoltz. And I actually like Joe Buck. I don't know what the whole deal is with so many fans hating him. I think he's actually an outstanding broadcaster. But the whole Hall of Famer fill in the blank, he does that with Troy Aikman too. It gets a little old after a while. I don't know if it's in his contract he has to do it. Or maybe there's a drinking game in the production truck where you have to throw one back every time he says Hall of Famer, but knock it off. Anyways, Hall of Famer John Smoltz, the biggest and probably most valuable card in the packs there. But other than that, a whole lot of, you know, just nothing there. And the fact that I didn't get the pack that might have something autographed in it, and considering that the regular pack was replaced, or two regular packs were replaced by the 92 Fleer Fat Pack, when you know, other than Frank Thomas and perhaps getting one of those Roger Clemens or the Fleer All-Star cards, there's not a whole lot in there. You know, at first when I looked through it, I'm like, okay, well, there's variety in packs here. And hey, I've had worse. And trust me, I've had worse. But the more I looked at it afterwards, I'm just like, that was garbage. That was not only the leftover But that was the leftover in the back of the fridge that you think was from this past Christmas, but it could be from the Christmas before. There might have been a little bit of blue fuzz on it. I'm not really sure. But I would not buy from this particular person again, not because I think they're terrible sellers. It's just that by the definition of their own product description, what I got barely met it. And then on top of that, you know, and I know it's luck of the draw here. I mean, it's a random assortment of packs. The ones I got were just not that good. and I think if you're a seller or if you're somebody who has a bunch of old packs laying around and you're thinking of doing this grab bag thing, you really have to give people a good reason to not only buy the first time, but after the first time go, yeah, I'm going to buy from that person again. And I've actually done that with some of the people that have put together the cello packs and the rack pack boxes that I've bought before, because they do throw in a couple of 83 tops in there, because they do throw in, you know, five or six 86 and 87 tops rack packs. You know, you can sell those back at a show for a dollar or two a piece, depending on the cards that you can see on the front or the back. And of course, with the 83, there's a chance of you're getting a Sandberg or a Gwynn or a Boggs rookie or an early Ripken or a Henderson, you know, those stars from the early 80s. So that's the hook there. If your hook is 81 Donruss, yeah, that's a pack because simply, you know, it's 39 years old now. Yeah, there's some value to it, and that's becoming harder and harder to get some of those packs, but it's not really one of those great packs where you go, hot damn, I got to buy from this person again. Because if I just want some 81 Donruss packs, I can buy four or five on eBay for, you know, $17 and, you know, open them up myself. So if you're somebody who does have a large collection of wax packs and you're thinking about selling them off in these little grab bags, make sure there's something pretty good in them. Not great. You don't need to go out and toss a 78 tops pack in there. It'd be nice if you do that. Let me know. But you do need to provide just a little bit of a tease, a little bit of a hook. Throw in that 85 tops pack if you got it. Throw in a couple of those 87 tops cellos if you got them. And, you know, basically invite the person to come back to you. In this case, I'm not going back to the seller. Again, just I wasn't overblown by the whole opportunities that were in there. They just weren't that great. I mean, really the best pack that I opened was the Garbage Pail Kids, and that's not how it's supposed to be. So if I had to, again, choose, if I had $17 and I had to go out and just buy random cards, I'm going to Walgreens and I'm buying three of those variety packs, because at least in that, I know I'm getting something that's autographed. I know I'm going to get some notable names and a pretty wide selection of cards. I've seen some people that, you know, they've sent pictures of those packs that they've opened up, those boxes, and, you know, there's cards from the 60s thrown in there, common cards, but you know, that's kind of neat. It's better than 92 Score. And 92 Score wasn't a bad set, but I'm certainly not going to spend much more time talking about that set because it's one of those forgotten junk wax era sets, and for many good reasons. So, in conclusion, if you're going to do the variety packs, make sure that, as always, when you're buying online, that you're getting it from a reputable dealer, somebody who has a 100% feedback rating, somebody who has feedback from at least several hundred people, if not into the thousands. Don't pick up somebody who's got 36 sales. I know that's kind of unfair to them. You've got to start somewhere. But if you're going to invest your money in unopened stuff, you need to make sure that you're getting it from somebody that actually has a pretty good track record of doing it right. And then make sure in the description of the item, it clearly spells out what you are going to get. Don't just go for the ones that go, you're going to get 100 baseball cards from the 80s. And you have to do the math and go, okay, that's what, six, seven packs? Because you know it's all 88 and 89, maybe an 87 thrown in there, and that's it. Make sure it's clearly spelled out what you're going to get. And if you get anything short of that, make sure you let the seller know. They'll either try to make it good or you stiffen with negative feedback, because if they really want you as a customer, they'll go, hey, yeah, that was a pretty lame pack here. I'm going to send you a couple of extras just to make it up. And then they'll probably send you two or three packs, maybe a goodie as well. And at least they hold up their end of the bargain that while it is a grab bag and while you're never really sure what you're going to get out of it, at least you feel like you got your money's worth, even if you are opening up a bunch of junk wax from the late 80s and early 90s. So that was my experience with leftovers, much like the food leftovers this time of year. Nothing to get all too excited about. All right, let's take a look at some of the players that we did pull from these packs, since I did open up four sports packs here. I got some interesting ones, and I will say, even though I didn't land, one of the big name cards in the 1981 Donruss pack, one of the big names, and it's simply because it's a fun name, and for Minnesota Twins fans in the late 70s, he was your hero. The one and only Bombo Rivera. Boy, when I saw Bombo Rivera, I just started chuckling. Jesus Bombo Rivera Torres, or as some people in Minnesota would go, Jesus Bombo. Of course, a native of Puerto Rico, and he was playing Little League ball as a kid, and he was a pretty powerful hitter. Not that he hit a whole lot of home runs, but he hit some really towering pop-ups. And not straight up. He got a little bit of an arc to it, but he would hit some very big pop-ups, and that got him a nickname of Bombo. People called him Bombo because of fly ball. It was just his big thundering fly ball. His father was a musician. Bombo Rivera, or Bombo Jr., actually, also was a musician. But, of course, stood out a little bit on the sports field, not only in baseball, but also track and field. He ran the 100 meters and also threw shot put for Ponce High School in Puerto Rico. Now, he was signed with the Montreal Expos in 1970, works his way up through the farm system, and eventually makes his major league debut in 1975. And he would, it's an amazing story with Bombo Rivera and his first home run. So even though he wasn't known for being a home run hitter, his first major league home run was so memorable because he hit it. I actually have the date of this here. And this is, by the way, thanks to our friends at the Society for American Baseball Research, the Sabre people. Let's see, who wrote this here? Oh, I had the name. Hang on here. Rory Costello. So Rory Costello of Sabre, thank you so much for doing this, because a lot of great stories in this project on Bombo Rivera. June 26, 1976, Bombo's first home run in the major leagues, an inside the park grand slam at Jarry Park in Montreal off of Jerry Royce, who was then playing with Pittsburgh. Royce, pretty good pitcher back then, too. But you always remember your first, and there's a whole lot going on in that statement there. First of all, it's against a pretty good pitcher in Jerry Royce. The Pirates were still a pretty good team in the mid-70s, but to do it against Roberto Clemente's old team, and of course, like a lot of youngsters in Puerto Rico, Bombo idolized the late Roberto Clemente, but also Jarry Park, which was a very big playing field, and if you could Bombo it up in the air just right, it kind of caught a jet stream and went over the fence, sometimes into the neighboring pool. But he was able to hit it in Jarry Park, the bases loaded, the bases clearing, I should say, inside the park, grand slam. Not too many people can say they did that. Now, unfortunately, in terms of power hitting, that was pretty much it for Bombo Rivera, as he was second fiddle to a lot of good young outfielders. The Expos had a lot of them, including Andre Dawson, who we'll get to in a little bit. He's one of the other players that we're going to talk about. But you had a lot of young talent coming up through the Expos system. Bombo Rivera was good, but not great. And that wasn't just in 1976. This kind of played out through the remainder of his career. So with this better talented outfield jumping over him and getting the playing time in Montreal, Bombo would play the entire 1977 season in the minor leagues. And that says a lot that the Expos didn't expose him to the expansion draft, at least to my knowledge. So Toronto and Seattle didn't pick him up. Clearly, I think he was better than outfielders were designated hitters for either of those teams in 77. But the Expos did eventually move his contract to the Minnesota Twins. The Twins, under Calvin Griffith, their owner at the time, notoriously cheap, as they didn't put in a lot of money into Metropolitan Stadium. In fact, the Met was falling apart in the late 70s. And they didn't put any money into payroll. As soon as players had the opportunity to become free agents starting in 1976, the Griffiths never brought them back. The players were either traded or they were lost to free agency. So great players like Burt Blyleven or Larry Heisel or Lyman Bostic would go test the waters of free agency, or the Twins would move them before they had to re-up them for contracts. So the Twins were a terrible team playing in a terrible, dumpy old stadium, playing for a terrible owner. So who comes to the rescue? Bombo Rivera. Starting in 1978, plays in 101 games for the Twins, bats 271, played for 112 games for the Twins in 1979. That would be a career high. He hit 281 that year. And then he languished a little bit in the 1980 season and was released after spring training in 1981. But he became a cult hero in the Twin Cities, as a lot of people would cheer Bombo, Bombo every time that he got up. But also, he had quite the following, too. Garrison Keillor, who was from the Twin Cities, actually wrote a song called The Ballad of Bombo Rivera. So when you're making such a cultural impact that an icon of old-fashioned radio, kind of this liberal presence, is writing songs about you, you know you're making an impact. He was also part of the book Shoeless Joe, written by W.P. Kinsella, that, of course, the impetus of the movie Field of Dreams several years later. And this is one of my favorite stories about Bombo Rivera. He was so popular in the late 70s in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area that in 1979, the University of Minnesota had an election for student council president, and he received so many write-in votes, he actually finished in second place. So if there was a better write-in vote campaign manager, Bombo Rivera could have been selected as the student council president for the Golden Gophers in 1979. Now, in 1981, rather, he was released by the Twins, signs with the Kansas City Royals for a little bit, has a very brief flirtation with them. In fact, only played five games for them in 1982. He would go on to Japan, was extremely successful in a couple seasons in Japan, also played for the Puerto Rican League, and later playing for the Senior Professional Baseball Association, first with the St. Petersburg Pelicans, and then the Florida Tropics, that's right. Not to be confused with any Will Ferrell movies. But the Tropics, that league ceased operations mid-season, so that was pretty much it for any kind of pro or semi-pro career. This totally blew my mind. I had no idea about this, but after his baseball career, Bombo Rivera was actually an employee at Tampa International Airport. That just boggles the mind, because my dad worked construction at Tampa International Airport for many years, a good 15 or so years. So who knows? I may have crossed paths with Bombo Rivera and had absolutely no idea. How crazy is that? Some tragedy for Bombo, unfortunately, as he had a five-year-old daughter who died from a brain tumor in December of 1995. However, did have a couple other surviving children, with over two marriages, the father of five children. And he is still very impactful in baseball, not in the Twin Cities. Although if you bring up the name Bombo Rivera, people get very giddy in Minnesota. But he is still extremely popular in Puerto Rico. He has been teaching baseball there for many, many years now. And we certainly wish him the best of luck. Not just a footnote in Expos and Twins trivia, but a great person by all accounts here. And a big fan of Gene Mauch, the poor beleaguered manager, who after nearly or who, yeah, nearly got the Phillies to the World Series in 1964. And this was just a few years after the Phillies lost like 106 games or something like that. Had to go through the expansion years of the Expos, had to go through some very lean years in Minnesota. Had a couple of chances with the Angels, but they blew two-nothing leads in best-of-five series in the ALCS in 1972. But that's one reason why Bombo Rivera was purchased by the Twins, was because Gene Mauch, of course, had him briefly in Montreal. And while he was not a star, he was certainly a serviceable player. Now, from the other packs of cards, one of my favorite players from my childhood, not necessarily because of anything he did on the field, but because he just looked so goofy, and you remember these things. Much like the name Bombo Rivera makes you chuckle, the images of third baseman Chris Sabo of the Cincinnati Reds will bring back funny memories, because Chris Sabo had those very special glasses that he wore, the wraparound eyeglasses, not the sunglasses, not like he's wearing Ray-Bans, but the rec specs that he had. He was one of the few ball players who was wearing eyeglasses when he was out on the field. And I remember the first time that I really recalled seeing Chris Sabo, at least over and over and over again, was the 1990 playoffs. So the NLCS with Pittsburgh, the World Series against Oakland, and he was a star in both of those series there, as the Reds would win the World Series. But I remember looking at him going, who let the lead singer from Devo on this team? And of course, Chris Sabo pretty much looks like every high school shop teacher across North America. But even though he had the rec specs, yes, even though he was protecting his eyes from the bandsaw and the collective sawdust that came out of it every time he powered it up, he was quite the athlete, not just a star in baseball, but he was also a hockey goalie. Growing up in the Detroit area, had a very brief experience with some lower level junior hockey when he was a kid. He was actually selected by the Reds in the 1983 draft after he was going to be drafted by the Montreal Expos. In fact, the Expos did draft him, but he decided to pick up a scholarship with the University of Michigan. Of course, Michigan with a pretty good hockey program as well, but decided to go the baseball route. Like I said, even though he had that junior experience briefly in the late 70s, in fact, was a teammate with the Niagara Falls Flyers with Steve Ludzik and Steve Larmer, two future players of the Chicago Blackhawks. But he decided not to do hockey. He went the baseball route, bypasses the pro career with the Expos. But he did star with Michigan, in fact, a team that went pretty far in the College World Series in 1983. As I mentioned, the Reds picking him up in the second round of the 83 draft, works his way up to the major leagues. And it's very interesting how he got his start in the major leagues, because the Reds had a veteran third baseman. They were kind of in a rebuilding mode in the mid to late 80s. But in 1988, Buddy Bell was supposed to be the starting third baseman, but Bell was injured. Now, Pete Rose was still managing the Reds, and because Sabo was not a stud player, but he was a very hard-working, gritty, blue-collar player, very much like Pete Rose was, Rose was impressed by him. He was impressed by his manner, his style of play, the fact that, yes, he could actually hit the ball and was also a pretty good fielder. So with Bell on the disabled list, Rose gives Sabo the start at the 1988 opener. So he collects his first major league hit. He also scores a run. He has a stolen base. He makes a couple of sparkling defensive plays in a 12-inning win over the Cardinals on opening day. And while Bell is still recovering from his injuries, Sabo is just absolutely starring for the Cincinnati Reds and basically just overtakes third base as the 1988 season plays out. He would win the National League Rookie of the Year award, of course, because of those rec specs. A lot of people, kind of liked him, you know, because it was just such an unusual look at the time. And even though he took a step backwards in 1989, as I mentioned, he was a big part of the Reds' World Series season in 1990. And he would actually have his best season in 1991. He had a career-high 301 batting average, also hit 26 home runs. had 88 RBI and 175 hits. Now, he had some injuries himself starting in 1992, really struggled for the next couple of seasons with the Reds, played briefly with Baltimore in 1994, and then would also play briefly for the White Sox and the Cardinals in 1995, just dealing with all sorts of injuries. And in 1996, comes back to Cincinnati. However, not only is dealing with Father Time here and dealing with more injuries, but also gets caught with a corked bat. Basically, he's playing in a game mid-season, hits a ball, the bat splinters everywhere, and cork just goes flying out. And he received a 7-game suspension, and Sabo would say, well, that's not my bat, that's somebody else's. And people would go, well, whose is it? Well, I don't know. You know, it's kind of like the cop's drug defense. It's not my weed. I don't know. Well, it was in your pocket. Who else could it be? I don't know. Somebody must have just put it in there. So Chris Sabo, with the cops or the live PD account for his corked bat, very a la Sammy Sosa, as the case would be several years later when Sosa was with the Cubs and shattered his bat against the Devil Rays. But anyways, his career would wrap up in 1996 as a player, 3-time All-Star National League Rookie of the Year, as I mentioned, also World Series champion and a member of the Cincinnati Reds Hall of Fame, and is also just finished up his first season as the head baseball coach at the University of Akron. Yes, the Akron Zips. Let's move along to Tony Pena, one of my favorite characters from growing up. And in fact, when I had dreams of delusion that one day I would be a good enough ball player to be a catcher, I wanted to be Tony Pena, because Tony Pena had that really unique squat. And you know what I'm talking about. He didn't actually squat. He sat on his leg. You know, he kind of tucked his right leg under his butt, sat on it, and extended his left leg out. Now, he did that when there were no runners on base. And one big reason why he did it was to help pitchers throw fastballs down in the zone, which was actually a very smart thing, especially as he came up through the Pittsburgh Pirates organization. Of course, the Pirates playing Three River Stadium and that awful turf that they had there. If you could get pitchers to pound it down low in the zone, most of the time, if the batter did connect, it was just this chopping ground ball. And as long as you had a decent enough infield around you, they could make the out rather easily. So Antonio Francisco Pena Padilla, from the Dominican Republic, quite the unique catcher here, as he was an undrafted free agent signed by the Pirates in 1975. He didn't start as a catcher. He was actually an outfielder, was converted to a catcher in 1977 as he's moving up through the minor leagues. As I mentioned, that very unique posture of his behind the plate, something that fans remembered real well. Starting in 1981, platooning the catcher position along with Steve Nicosia. However, Pena stood out, hitting a .300 batting average in 66 games, was a sixth place, I don't want to say finalist, but finished sixth place in voting for the 1981 National League Rookie of the Year Award. By 1982, he's the starting catcher in Pittsburgh and had a phenomenal long run as the catcher in Pittsburgh. In fact, four of his 5 All-Star appearances came with Pittsburgh, 82, 84, 85, and 86. However, right before the start of the 1987 season, he's part of a big trade between Pittsburgh and St. Louis, as the Pirates sent Pena to St. Louis for Mike LaValle and Andy Van Slyke, 2 pieces that would be key in the Pirates' resurgence and their 3 consecutive NLCS appearances in, 89, 90, and 91. Or no, I'm sorry, 90, 91, 92. There we go. And Pena took the trade very hard. He did not like leaving Pittsburgh. That was the team that he had spent, by that point in time, 12 seasons with, either in the minor leagues or in the major leagues. And it took him a little while to adjust. However, despite that adjustment and having to deal with some injuries, the Cardinals would turn out to be the better team, as they would make it all the way to the World Series, losing to the Twins in 7 games that year. And Pena would continue to star behind the plate for the next 2 seasons, including his 5th and final All-Star season in 1989. Now, he was granted free agency, signs a contract with the Boston Red Sox, He led American League catchers in 1990 in games played, range factor, putouts, finished second in assist and in fielding percentage. He picked up a Gold Glove award then. That was, or in 1991, he picked up Gold Glove. He was just the second catcher at that time, along with Bob Boone, to earn a Gold Glove in both the American and National Leagues. I forgot to mention, he was a three-time Gold Glove winner with Pittsburgh in 83, 84, and 85, and of course helped the Red Sox and their pitching staff not only win the American League East, but also give a little bit of a battle to the Oakland A's before they went on to the World Series and lost to Cincinnati. Now, he would become a free agent again in 1994. Signs with the Cleveland Indians, was a key cog in the Indians' American League championship team that would eventually lose to the Atlanta Braves, but he was that veteran voice, that vibrant veteran voice in a pretty young Indians locker room at the time. And you got to have that with teams. You have to have that guy that's been around the block a few times, but he's also loose as a goose and kind of keeps the locker room atmosphere light as well. He was well regarded, not only by Indians teammates, but fans and coaches as well. After the 1996 season, goes to the Chicago White Sox as a free agent, would play there until August of 97, and then finishes up his playing career at the age of 40 with the Houston Astros. Now, of course, that's not the end of Tony Peña. He would get into the coaching realms very quickly, would become the manager in Kansas City in 2002, led the Royals to what was at that time their most successful season. In 2003, they went 83-79. They were throwing parades for Kansas City in Kansas City for the Royals because that was their best season since 1994. And of course, as it would turn out, it would be their best season up until about 2014 when they made the first of consecutive World Series appearances. So Peña had that moment in the sun in 2003. However, the team slipped back in 2004 and in fact lost 104 games. And then he was released from his duties early in 2005. Became the first base coach, later bench coach for the New York Yankees. Often overlooked as a managing replacement, first in New York, later in Boston. In fact, he was bypassed for Bobby Valentine in 2011. That was a good move. And Peña has since moved on to doing some international coaching. In fact, he was the manager of the Dominican Republic national baseball team in the World Baseball Classic, the WBC. That year, Dominican team would go 8-0 with a 3-0 championship victory over Puerto Rico as they went undefeated throughout the whole tournament. And he was part of the Yankees coaching staff up until or through 2017. Aaron Boone comes in, replacing Joe Girardi as the manager, and eventually Peña let go. Peña's kids, very involved in baseball. Of course, you probably know about Tony Jr. as well as catcher Francisco Peña. Also, his brother, Ramon Peña, briefly was a pitcher for the Detroit Tigers back in the 1989 season, had a little cup of coffee with the parent club. And finally, Andre Dawson, the Hawk, awesome Dawson. We pulled him out of two of the packs here. In fact, I think 92 Fleer and 92 Score. Loved Andre Dawson. That man could mash. Unfortunately, his knees got mashed way too often. And in fact, knee injuries started when he was playing football in high school in Miami. So it was the first of many knee injuries and subsequent knee surgeries he would need. Unfortunately for Andre Dawson, when he was with the Montreal Expos, the turf at Olympic Stadium, of course, it wasn't just Olympic Stadium, it was a lot of National League parks at this time, just totally tore up his knees and probably reduced the greatness of his career, although he certainly had a great career, good enough to get him into the Baseball Hall of Fame on the 9th ballot back in 2010. Originally, the 11th round pick, number 250 of the 1975 MLB draft, very quickly moved up through the Montreal farm system and made his major league debut September 11th, 1976. And he became an everyday outfielder for the Expos in 77, wins the National League Rookie of the Year award with a .282 batting average, 19 home runs, and 21 stolen bases, and just becomes one of the many great young kids, along with Tim Raines and Warren Cromartie and Gary Carter, of course. You can name it, all those Expos stars from the late 70s and early 80s, the Hawk was one of the big ones for many, many years. Moved from center to right to give his knees a little bit of a break a little later on in his career, and was going to become a big-dollar free agent following the 1986 season. Of course, the Expos starting to dismantle the team by then. You had the Gary Carter trade in 85. A lot of the other big players from those teams in the late 70s and early 80s were gone or wrapping up their careers. So Dawson thinks he's going to hit the big time and just back up the Brinks truck as a free agent and a well-deserved free agent. He had three All-Star appearances in 81, 82, and 83. Like I said, that National League Rookie of the Year. He had six consecutive Gold Gloves in the outfield, three Silver Slugger Awards at this point in time. He should have been one of the big fish free agents after the 1986 season. But, of course, you have the Major League Baseball owner collusion going on then. They're trying to artificially keep the contract prices down. So all the big names become free agents and nobody can find a big contract anywhere. And in fact, the only reason why Andre Dawson ended up at the Chicago Cubs, even though Dallas Green, who was the general manager, was putting up a big public storm against Andre Dawson, was Dawson and his agent Dick Moss showed up in 1987 training camp with a blank contract that was made out to the Cubs and said, here, just put a dollar value. Whatever you want to pay him, just put it here. So the Cubs decide to pay Dawson a $500,000 salary. That was second lowest on the team for regular players. And they added these bonuses, and they're insulting now when you think about it. So $150,000 if he didn't go on the disabled list by the All-Star break, $50,000 if he made the All-Star team. And there was also a bonus if Dawson was the MVP of either the NLCS or the World Series. So here's Dawson faced with this dilemma. Okay, do I take this insulting contract and hope I stay healthy, or do I keep shopping my services? Well, he couldn't land anything anywhere else, so he signs with the Cubs, and boy, does he deliver. First of all, playing on the natural turf at Wrigley Field helps out a lot, so he doesn't get injured. He is named an All-Star, so he cashes in on those $200,000 in bonuses. The problem is the Cubs are a terrible team in 1987. In fact, finished 76 and 85, the worst in the National League East. But with Dawson being the starting right fielder, hitting 49 home runs that equaled what Mark McGwire put up in Oakland, he was the National League MVP. He was the first MVP of a last place team. He would play five more seasons for the Cubs, was an extremely popular player throughout the next several years, and eventually would sign with the Boston Red Sox in 1993. Hits his 400th career home run on April 15th, 1993. Dealt with some knee injuries later on in his career. Would play the final two seasons of his career with the Florida Marlins, of course, in his hometown of Miami, and then would wrap it up. Dawson, by the way, is an author as well, released an autobiography several years ago, called If You Love This Game, An MVP's Life in Baseball. I'm now going to have to search that book out because I'm curious how that is. And he became a business owner. He owns the Mahogany Grill, that is a soul food restaurant in Miami Gardens. Also, and I found this interesting, I actually found an article on AARP. It was a Google search. I'm not a member of AARP. I'm not that old yet. But Andre Dawson is now the primary owner of a funeral home. Now, a lot of people think that's appropriate because if you're playing for the Marlins, your career is dead. But that's not the case. In fact, he tells in this story, after he retired in 1996, he and several family members had invested in a funeral home, and he was just a minority investor. Well, eventually there was another funeral home, I think it was 2008, something like that, that was up for sale. In fact, it was foreclosed. The previous owner took some shortcuts and really got, you know, a whole lot of, you know, charges filed against him for running a really shoddy business. And Dawson wasn't originally going to buy the funeral home, but he's talking to several community people, several pastors in the area, and they're really afraid that, all right, if we lose this funeral home, we lose this service, and now if we need to conduct a funeral or have, you know, bodies interred, now we've got to go all over the place and pay more to do it. So he and his wife took it upon themselves to buy this funeral home. They completely redeveloped it, changed the name to Paradise Memorial Funeral Home, hired a whole bunch of part-time employees. He does a lot of work himself, and he finds himself in the very unusual situation of being the sounding board for grieving families. So that's just amazing. Here's a baseball Hall of Famer who was part of that young and exciting Expos squad in the late 70s and early 80s, had to fight off a ridiculous, and in fact, you could almost say racist contract offer from the Chicago Cubs during the collusion of the mid-80s, extended his career in Boston and in Miami. And here he is, he's running a funeral home, and he's, you know, not just collecting money off the side, he's actually like involved in the day-to-day operations and dealing with the emotional highs and lows of having to deal with families who are at their most vulnerable, who are, you know, burying loved ones. So I found that very interesting that Andre Dawson, the Hawk, is now overseeing a funeral home, one of many businesses in Miami, but quite the interesting twist to a very interesting career. And I'll throw in one more twist about Andre Dawson. I don't think I've told this story before, but I had an English teacher in the ninth grade. Her name was Joan Hasbrook. And I don't even know if she's alive anymore, because, I mean, the ninth grade was, you know, 26, 27 years ago. And she was already, I'd say, probably in her mid to late 60s then. So if she's alive, it's quite honestly a miracle, although I wouldn't be surprised if she was. And Mrs. Hasbrook was a huge Detroit Tigers fan, but she was an even bigger Andre Dawson fan. And it's a shame that Andre Dawson never played for the Detroit Tigers. She would have fainted back then. But even though Mrs. Hasbrook was a tough customer as an English teacher, and she had this really, really premier voice, you know, this little old lady, I mean, just little tiny body, but she had this real regal, royal voice, Mrs. Hasbrook. And we used to make fun of her, too, because of that voice of hers. But even though she could be a real pain in the ass, to be honest with you, as a teacher, I got on her good side because I was such a big baseball fan. And because I was a Blue Jays fan and she was a Tigers fan, you know, we were always going at each other because the Jays and the Tigers back in 90, 91, 92, around this time that I had her as a teacher, you know, they were kind of going back and forth in the standings for quite a bit. So we would constantly rib each other about the baseball teams. But she loved Andre Dawson. Like I said, Dawson was finishing up his career with the Cubs, or his time with the Cubs, I should say. And she would just get all hot and bothered about Andre Dawson. Oh, Andre Dawson, I love him. And it was just so funny to see this little old lady who could be a real, you know what, if she wanted to, just melting at the thought of Andre Dawson. I don't know, maybe it's the tight pants, I don't know. But she just loved Andre Dawson. And when he signed with the Red Sox in 92, I remember giving her some hell, going, oh, well, now, you know, you get to see Andre Dawson against the Tigers every now and then. Because, of course, the Red Sox and Tigers were in the same division back then. And, you know, her heart was all a flutter. Oh, I get to see Andre Dawson. So for Joan Hasbrook, wherever you are, I hope you enjoyed the look back at Andre Dawson. And I'm not going to make any funeral home jokes with you, Mrs. Hasbrook. That would be incredibly cruel. But I think everyone else, you know where I'm going with that. And with that, I'm going to wrap it up here. Our leftovers have certainly lasted longer than they should have, much like many of the cards in the pack that I did buy that I'll never buy again. But I'm still always intrigued on the leftover packs of cards that are available. because sometimes you never know. Sometimes you get that dealer that does throw in those gem packs, those very interesting fun packs to open up. And whether you spend $17 or $70 on a box of random packs, hopefully you have some fun opening them up. And even if you do get a bunch of duds like I did, at least you know, all right, maybe the sports cards weren't that great. Maybe I did get a Hall of Famer drink, John Smoltz card in the 91 Leaf pack. But the non-sports cards were actually probably the best cards, which, again, that's not how it's supposed to be. But I did enjoy the Garbage Pail Kids. I might open the Desert Storm cards because I'm looking for that rookie Dick Cheney card that everyone's clamoring for. But we all know we're just waiting for the 1991 pop pack to be opened. And I might just do that one day just so we can all find that Callaway card and we can all hum, I want to be rich. Because don't we all want to be rich? We certainly didn't want to be Callaway, but one day we'll be rich. Certainly not opening up the leftover packs like I just did. Thanks again for joining me on Wax Ecstatic. Don't forget to make your cash donations to paypal.me/waxecstatic to help support the program, help us find the cards that we talk about on the show, and also deliver cards to Commons for Kids. And our next show will be delivered to you 2 weeks from today, Friday, January 17th. Keep an eye out for it and follow us, as always, on Twitter @WaxAndGumStains.